Access number 28670, Mr. David Wilson, Real 6. Now, we're talking about when you were at Borden, Havana Barracks, Borden, doing this vehicle engineers course, but we haven't actually done when you started that yet. How did the course start?
Well, it started, I suppose, initially at Barton Stacey when at the end of the 4 weeks driver training, each individual went in front of the PSO, the personnel selection officer, to determine the career that he was going to follow, or the trade he was going to follow in the army. And it's, in all modesty, I think they were looking for those people who had a background, or certainly part of their apprenticeship at least, in motor vehicle technology to go as armoured fighting vehicle mechanics. So I was selected for a VM AFV3, which is the first grade course at Borden in Hampshire, which Havana Barracks.
Now, we mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What happened
when
you got there? Then how did the course?
Yeah. Well, the instructions were to attend to join course 42 VM AFV. When we got there, when I got there among a group of people, apparently the turned out to be three too many for 42 VM AFV, so the typical army fashion, they just took the alphabetical list and took the last three names off the bottom, which happened to belong to Wilson, myself, and a chap called Ron Welding, and a bloke called Jimmy Whittaker. So we ended up as sort of three musketeers hanging about for a fortnight, waiting until the 43 VM course was formed and started running parallel with 42 VM AFV.
Now, what was the course? What were they teaching you?
Well, the course there was quite a lot of classroom work. It was vehicle technology with emphasis on the type of power unit that was used in tanks, which was the Rolls-Royce Meteor. That was a diesel section as well, but we did mainly the Meteor.
Now, what were the characteristics of the Rolls-Royce Meteor?
Well, the Meteor was a detuned version of the Merlin. It was a V12, inclined at 90 degrees, not 45 as the Liberty engines were. It was it produced, I recall, 650 brake horse at 2250 RPM. It's hardly ticking over, and it's 650 horsepower. Of course, in an aircraft, it was supercharged, and the horsepower output was far above that level. But it wasn't necessary for the tanks, so it didn't have a supercharger. Otherwise, it was identical to the Merlin that was fitting the Spitfire and the Hurricane and the Lancasters. It was complex, and really, it was so, the engine itself was so totally reliable that all I remember doing with the regiment was just simply plug changes, cleaning air filters, and this sort of thing.
But what did they teach you to do? Do you see what I mean? That's what you actually ended up.
Oh, yes. Well, the course itself would the information practice you've got would enable you to rebuild one. You could dismantle and rebuild the complete engine as later on the course you did a transmission and at a diesel. There was a diesel section as well. And it was basic principles right through to dismantling and rebuilding. One little story about the diesel, the section that we did on diesel, we had this mad lecturer who used to demonstrate the diesel injection pump. And demonstrate what happened inside a combustion chamber, he would set an injector up on the test pump, and then he would blow through fuel through it at high pressure and ignite it with his cigarette lighter, and there was a flame used to shoot the whole length of the gangway between two sets of desks, right from one end of the room to the other, and frighten the living daylight out of everybody, because it was his party trick. In health and safety at work and education didn't exist, of course. But it was generally, as I say, it was a comprehensive course. It was just the basic course. That was class three, and it was mainly basic principles, as I say, followed up by some practical work. There was also practical bench work, where you had to produce the usual test piece with a square piece of steel with a hole cut in the middle, and produce a block that would go in, filed up, and would go in every way. You know, you could turn it.
Was this a proper trade test? I mean,
it wasn't so much a trade test as a trade. Well, I suppose the filing and doing a test piece, I suppose, was at the end of the workshop course. They seemed to go in fortnights. You had a fortnight on transmission, a fortnight on engine, fortnight diesel, fortnight practical in the shop. That was 12 weeks in total. I can't remember the rest of the subjects, but certainly the last fortnight was driver training on the Cromwell. Some guys got the Comet, but we had a Cromwell.
Now, what training did you get on the Cromwell?
Well, the Cromwell itself, of course, was actually had all of the component parts that we had done our training on. You had the Rolls-Royce Meteor engine, you had the Merritt Brown transmission, you had of course there wasn't any diesel versions, but as I say, mainly the course itself was centred on both the Cromwell and the Comet, which were very much in use at the time. The Centurion was just coming on, but it was...
What was the Cromwell like? Can you give us a sort of review of its
characteristics? I loved the Cromwell. The Cromwell was to me, I know it had sort of a bad press for light frontal armour and too lightly armed and this sort of thing, but I do believe that it was the fastest tank in the British Army, if not the fastest tank in any army at one stage. We used to mess about with the governors, I must say, later on, but you could go and get it doing 45 mile an hour on the main road, but of course the Cromwell, as opposed to the Comet, when they introduced top rollers on the track, the Cromwell didn't have any top rollers, and if the tracks were slacked off for cross country, and you got onto a road and you made it go, they used to rattle against the side of the hull like somebody, like banging on the side of a biscuit tin. The racket inside was tremendous. But I thought the Cromwell was superb. There was only one or two little things that put me off a bit, but at that time...
What were they?
Well, I wasn't claustrophobic at that time, but I do remember if the turret was in the forward position, if it was facing forwards, the overhang of the turret tended to make access and egress, which was the important thing, from the driver and co-driver's compartment very difficult, because it was a right angle hatch, and in fact I would say for anybody with a bit of weight on, it was impossible to get out. So it was, that was a snag, a big snag. You could see under battle conditions, people wanting to get out would obviously feel very upset when they couldn't, if the turret was facing the wrong way. For visibility, of course, you just had a little round porthole, probably about 10, 11 inches in diameter, and I think it was a foot, and you were in a very limited view. And of course, if you have battened down into the periscope, you saw next to nothing. You just kept belting on, you know. But the transmission was good. Five-speed constant measure gearbox. and reverse, of course. And of course, the thing about the Cromwell, which they discovered, I believe, they discovered by accident, was that with a Merritt Brown gearbox and the sort of epicyclic transmission, the sun and planet wheel type of transmission they had, you had a neutral turn, which meant that you could go up a blind alley and turn on your centre point. All you did was leave it in neutral and just heave on one tiller, and it would follow that tiller around. One track going one way and the other one went the other way, and you revolved on your centre point, which was better than the Sherman, which had to be backed out of of every situation. And generally speaking, I always think of the Cromwell, if you...
What did you think of the armour? Or was it not something really concerned?
Well, to me at the time, the armour seemed to be quite massive. It seemed to be adequate. But sort of having listened to people afterwards and read accounts of actions in the Second World War, it was inadequate compared to the German stuff. I think it was equal to the Sherman. There was just a lot of Shermans about, and so it didn't matter. But the 88 obviously were too much for any of our armoured fighting vehicles at the time.
What about the armament?
Well, the armament, again, that's something that I really wasn't concerned with, in as much as it was a VM AFV course rather than a gunfitter's course.
Oh, I just mean as a tank.
As a tank.
I know you weren't studying it.
Well, it seemed to be out of thought. It would have been quite a powerful weapon. The
what was it?
I think it was a 72mm. Seems to come to mind. I know I've seen the one that knocked the famous one in the IWM that put the round through the back of the guy's name escapes me, the one that knocked 20 of ours out and then finally the Cromwell nailed him, but it was from the back. So it was possible, I suppose, if you hit them in the right place, the Cromwell could be effective. But
now, what were the different crew roles? What did each member of the crew do? I know you'd only learn driving.
Well, yeah, this is it. Well, we're learning
but
driving.
What were the others doing?
Well, you had the tank commander, of course, you had a commander who ran the show, and then you had a gunner loader, and a co-driver who had a Beza, the Beza machine gun, in his compartment, which was identical to the driver's compartment, except that it didn't have a two tillers and the clutch and the rest of the controls. So it was a four-man crew.
No wireless operator then?
The tank commander did his own communications.
Now, how did you drive it then? What were the controls?
Well, the controls were, you sat with, you had the gear stick between your knees, the gate was between your knees, and the two tillers, left and right.
And they controlled what?
They controlled the tracks, the steering. You had the normal clutch, brake and throttle. It's when you and of course starting up behind you had a control box, and you had a car gas system that you pumped when it was cold, and it injected petrol vapor into the inlet manifold, and then you started up, and once it got started, you declutched as on any normal vehicle. Shoved it into second. If you put it into first for climbing steep gradients or onto a transporter, you can't get it out of first. You cannot change out of first to second with a constant measure gearbox. That's too much torque on it, So you kick it off in second. And I always remember the instructor, lad called Keach, Lance Corporal Keach, and he... He said, if any of you lot burn my clutch out, I'll throttle you. And so we took steps. Actually, what you had to do was just simply let it out without slipping it at all. You just simply put your foot on, shoved it in second gear, and simply took your foot straight off the clutch. And it just, the front end of the tank lifted, and you're rolling forward. You couldn't really stall them. You had to be an idiot to stall them, you know. Then you drove it without touching the tillers till you actually needed to steer. Because the thing about the steering tiller arrangement and the Merritt Brown gearbox is that if you ever got into a situation where both tillers were pulled at the same time, the contra-rotating forces in the gearbox would blow it apart. Of course, there was interlock valves as a safety feature, so you couldn't do that. Just as an aside, it's relevant to the Cromwell and to the Comet. But when the Centurion was introduced, it was decided that from the reliability point of view, it would be best to do away with the hydraulics, which were the hydraulic steering gear anyway, the steering controls, which had a load of pipework underneath the engine, which meant that to repair it, you had to remove the engine, which was ridiculous. So there was this, I think it was, according to what I heard, it was a Remy staff sergeant at Tiffy who dreamed up this simple method of an interlocking device. There was a lug welded into the hull and a hardened sliding plate just ran into indents in the control rods of each tiller, from each tiller. So that meant if you had one tiller pulled and the locking plate was located in the, say it was the right hand tiller and the locking plate was located in the left, there's no way you could pull the left hand tiller until you let go of the other one, which was simple and straightforward, and it worked a treat. Whereas the Cromwell had hydraulic interlock valves and used to leak, and you kept your both hands very close to the tillers, and as you went to track left, obviously you just heaved on the left hand stick, left hand tiller. But the thing about the Cromwell, where you had to get used to driving the British tankers against, say, the Sherman, was it depended upon which gear you were in as to how tight your turning circle was. So if you were in too high a gear, if you got carried away and you were charging along in third and you came to a tight corner, as a lot of people, you didn't have time to come down the box and hauled on the tiller and you ran out the road and suddenly you were demolishing things that you didn't expect to, you know. So this was the thing. You had to be in the appropriate gear for the corps for a manoeuvre. You simply turned the tiller in the direction you wanted to be, and then you released it straight away. So your hands just sort of rested on the tillers all the time, and the other work, your clutch, brake, and throttle was simply done on pendant pedals as per a motor car or a heavy goods vehicle.
Did you find it difficult to get the hang of it?
Not at all. Found it was very easy. The two hands used to come off the tillers when you were changing gear, and you just simply had a gear gate, so you just simply followed it, you know. And the gearbox was very forgiving. The controls themselves were lively, and I found it very manoeuvrable. And once you got the hang of letting your foot off the clutch and not slipping it, we used to double the clutch sometimes, but it wasn't necessary. There was a trick that we learned whereby you could do clutchless changes. And what all you did was, it didn't matter which tiller it was, instead of dipping the clutch, if you just flicked the tiller and use your right hand, flick the tiller with, say, your left hand or whatever, if you were left-handed, you would do it the other way, and use the other one on the gear change. When you flicked the tiller, it took the weight off the transmission for an instant, just similar to dipping the clutch. and you could pop it through. And they used to make virtual racing changes. I've seen some guys who were really slick at it, and they would come past you if you were watching, and all you saw was the track tension, just for a fraction of a second, and oh, he was in gear and he was away. As I say, the Cromwell was, haven't seen it, sort of over an extended period. One of the most impressive, I think of it as a little tank, but it was 32 ton, 33, I think was the last Mark 4A or whatever it was. So it was. It wasn't just a reconnaissance tank. But there again, after having said that, I think it did become used, particularly by the artillery, for reconnaissance, you know.
Now, so you were being trained, you had a couple of weeks on this driving course at the end. What about other things about tank? I mean, as a vehicle mechanic, would you have to learn how to change the tracks?
Absolutely.
You haven't mentioned it. How would you change?
Fortunately, the tracks on a Cromwell could be split and changed.
But what do you mean?
There's a pin to you ground it off, ground the head off, and punched it out. But actually, after having said that, the track changing was, believe it or not, a driver's job. It was. It wasn't something we spent a lot of time on. You knew how to. It was quite obvious. There was a technique. We never used it, but there was a technique whereby you used to get used to put a small charge on the link and blow it apart, which I always thought was a little bit like taking a quarter hour to take the top off an egg. You know, all you had to do was grind the pin off and punch it out. You know, with a hammer and punch.
So how would you do it?
I would do it with a hammer and punch, a grinder and hammer and punch. But
you'd take out the damaged link and then.
First of all, you would want you had to have pinch bars to support the track, and you would split it at a point just near the idler. And the idler on the Cromwell was at the front because it was driven from the rear sprocket, as opposed to the American Sherman. So you split it just by the idler.
An idler is a sorry.
It's an adjust. It's the adjustable wheel at the front of the Cromwell. It's adjustable with a bolt, a stop bolt, a large lug which is threaded. The stub bolt goes up against the pivot point of the idler, which itself is pivoted to take up the tension. It's a tensioner it's like a chain tensioner, except in this case it's a track tensioner.
So you put the brake near that.
And then with the two pinch bars, a couple of guys on pinch bars, you would roll it forward, up in front of the tank. And the reason for that being that you could actually drive forward over the track and then pull it up again back over the back sprocket, like, you know, when you came to do the reverse and put the track back on. But the only times that you would change tracks or get involved in an operation like that would be if it was badly worn and you were replacing it, or alternatively if it had come off, if it had been too slack, and it had anybody cornering a bit over enthusiastically, they could push them off. But it was very rarely that happened, even with a slack track in cross.
So
cross
normally, country. If you're just taking one out, what would you do? Just take that one out?
Or take a link out. Oh, yes. Just like a bicycle chain.
And then was it easy enough to put the next it back in? How did you get it tensioned?
Well, a new pin, and you rivet it over. And of course, the tension, once you've got it on the sprocket and on the front idler, and you've got it connected up and the pin in, you've got to tension it by adjusting this bolt which pushed the pivoted idler forward to take the tension up. And of course, you had to have just a running clearance on the main road, but of course cross country you would back it off a bit to give it a bit of slack in case you got a build up of rubbish in between the road wheel tyres and the track, you know. But, as I say, we didn't find much trouble.
Any other big jobs you had to learn how to do on the Cromwell?
Well, it's eventually, although it wasn't supposed to be done, this was later on, I actually...
We'll go on to that.
This is the training.
Anything else you learned to do in training at Havana?
Of course, the rest of the time was taken up with the ancillary things, such as radiators and clutches. The clutch, for instance, had three lives, I remember. There was a series of wedges in the clutch fingers, and when the centre plate wore and it became thinner and the clutch fingers came out, it started to slip, you could reverse these wedges. There was actually three positions on these L-shaped wedges, and you could turn them round and bolt them back in again, and it gave the clutch a further life. And of course, once this had been done the third time, you need to put a clutch in, you know. So that was one thing I recall about it. So you learned how to change a clutch, you learned how to adjust a clutch, and then there was radiators. There was two radiators in the engine compartment.
What were you learning about that?
Well, radiators were mainly it wasn't so much radiator repair, it was removing and reinstalling. And, of course, that was the ancillary air filters, plugs to change, mags to change, which meant engine timing and doing the points. And there was a governor on there, which you could adjust. The governor held it to 2,250 RPM, and once it got above that, it started to misfire, and you could hear it crackling in the big so-called silencers at the back of the hull. Right. Because the
air cleaners.
They had a large oil bath air cleaner, which was handy certainly in the desert, it held something like. About 5 gallons of oil, normal engine, ordinary engine oil, and this was, of course, as a medium to trap the particles so they didn't get sucked into the inlet manifold. There was another thing I remember. You had a fire warning system.
What was that built
into the tank? Well, it consisted of particularly in the engine compartment, you had these thermal switches, which had a sort of lead link in, or a low melting point metallic link. And if the temperature in the engine compartment reached a stage where it was over the melting point of the link, it melted. The two contacts made contact, and there was a klaxon used to sound in the hull and in the driver's compartment and in the fighting compartment. And depending on how windy you were, you either bailed out a bit sharpish, or there was a series of fire extinguishers. The one in there were CO2 extinguishers, and there was one lot operated from the driver's compartment, and his job was to immediately pull out the two pins either side of his body, put his arms up and press two levers hard, press them because he had to puncture the CO2 bottle seals. And then there was a system of pipework went through the tank, mainly in the engine compartment and onto the fuel tanks, and discharged through sort of conical nozzles onto the appropriate danger areas.
So it was a carbon dioxide?
It was a CO2 system, yeah. And the... I cannot recall the controls inside the turret, but I do remember the CO2 bottles in the driving compartment.